B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, June 4th, 2018. Thanks for grabbing the PBC podcast. And let me invite you to share it far and wide with your friends. We're always looking for new ears to burn. And I hope you can help us out with that. So the Supreme Court today issued what is described as a very narrow ruling. It allegedly doesn't set a precedent. But it reveals much about the composition of today's court. Now, this is with the addition of Neil Gorsuch, the court that approved same-sex marriage, found it constitutional. But today, they ruled for the religious freedom to discriminate against gay couples who wanted to buy a wedding cake. The case came from Colorado, where Jack Phillips, who's been running a bakery and half his revenues at the Masterpiece Cake Shop in Lakewood outside Denver, come from making beautiful wedding cakes. But when Charlie Craig and Dave Mullins dropped in and said, "Hey, we want to order a cake," he said, "No, that would violate my religious principles." And the court upheld the right of Jack Phillips to reject their business solely because he did not approve of a man marrying a man. Now, this is fundamentally very clear discrimination. A commercial enterprise saying that we can pick and choose from the people who come through our door which customers we will serve based on religious bigotry. Now, the court doesn't use the term bigotry, but that's what it is. And so the principle here that is being upheld is that if you say God told you to do it, you can violate the law and discriminate against individuals, even those who are protected by a state-level statement of civil rights and human rights. That is the law in Colorado. And they went before the Civil Rights Commission of Colorado, which ruled in favor of the gay couple. And ultimately, that's what was overturned by the Supreme Court today, as Justice Anthony Kennedy, I know I can say that, writing for the 7-member majority, said that, well, the way this was handled by the Civil Rights Commission, he said, was unacceptable. The neutral and respectful consideration to which Mr. Phillips was entitled was compromised, and that there was clear and impermissible hostility toward the sincere religious beliefs that motivated his objection. And this is as bad as the Hobby Lobby decision, where they found that corporate owners with religious values can impose those values on the people who work for that corporation. And this is truly dangerous and insidious. It's a clear violation of my First Amendment right of freedom from religion. And an outrageous ruling by this court. Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the dissent, joined by Sonia Sotomayor. The court also entered a case, and while I appreciate that they didn't pursue sanctions against the ACLU as demanded by the Trump administration, the court intervened and dismissed a lower court's decision that had permitted an undocumented immigrant teenager to get an abortion over the protests of the God Squad appointed by Trump. This is at the Refugee Resettlement Office, and they said, well, we're not going to facilitate her abortion. And so they violated her rights as a resident of the United States under Roe v. Wade. So again, in a narrow ruling, and this is an unsigned opinion without any noted dissents, they threw out the case because it was moot. She had already gotten an abortion. But the silver lining here is the court did not agree with a separate request by the Trump administration that ACLU lawyers who represented the girl be disciplined for their actions in representing her appropriately in the case. Meanwhile, the Russiagate hysteria continues in this country, and there was a rational piece published recently at the Nation's website under the byline of a former ambassador to Russia, Jack Matlock. And while I don't agree with everything that Matlock asserts or concludes, it is somewhat refreshing to see someone step back and say, for example, what are the facts here? Well, he says it's a fact that some Russians paid people to act as online trolls and bought ads on Facebook during and after the 2016 campaign, and many of them were trivial, and the whole effort was a modest fraction of all the ads that were placed. Number two, it's a fact that emails in the memory of the Democratic National Committee's computer system were furnished to WikiLeaks. The U.S. intelligence agencies that issued the report in January of 2017 were confident that Russians hacked the emails and supplied them to WikiLeaks, but they have offered no evidence to substantiate their claim. Even if one accepts that Russians were the perpetrators, however, the emails were genuine, as the U.S. intelligence report certified. And he adds, I have always thought that the truth was supposed to make us free, not degrade our democracy. That always has been amusing to me, that so many people dismiss the contents of the emails because they were told that they had cooties from Russia. I mean, no matter how they became public, the information is just as damaging if you actually pay attention. Then he goes to number three. It's a fact that the Russian government established a sophisticated television service, RT, that purveyed entertainment, news, and propaganda to foreign audiences, including those in the United States. Its audience is several magnitudes smaller than that of Fox News. Basically, its task is to picture Russia in a more favorable light than what is available in the Western media. There has been no analysis of its effect, if any, on voting in 2016. Then he goes to number four. It's a fact that many senior Russian officials, though not all by any means, expressed a preference for Trump's candidacy. After all, Clinton had compared Putin to Hitler, had urged more active U.S. military intervention abroad. Trump had said it would be better to cooperate with Russia than treat it as an enemy. And as a former ambassador says, on a personal level, most of my Russian friends and contacts were dubious of Trump, but all resented the Clinton's Russophobic tone. Number five, there is no evidence that Russian leaders thought Trump would win or they could have had a direct influence on the outcome. Number six, no evidence that Russian activities had any tangible impact on the outcome of the election, and nobody seems to have done even a superficial study of the effect Russian actions actually had on the vote. And his final point, there's also no evidence that there was direct coordination between the Trump campaign, hardly a well-organized effort, he said in parentheses, and Russian officials. The indictments brought by the special counsel so far are either for lying to the FBI or for offenses unrelated to the campaign, like money laundering or failure to register as a foreign agent. He says, I did not personally vote for Trump, but I consider the charges that Russian actions interfered in the election, or for that matter, damaged the quality of our democracy, ludicrous, pathetic, and shameful. And he expands on each of those. I'll quote the shameful part. Shameful because it is an evasion of responsibility. It prevents the Democrats and those Republicans who want responsible, fact-based government in Washington from concentrating on practical ways to reduce the threat the Trump presidency poses to our political values and even our future existence. I have a link to Matlock's piece. It's in the show file for today's podcast, and you can read it at your leisure. By the way, I want to mention that I am struggling today. I reduced the story count to 18 to try to jam into half an hour, and I left a good 6 or 8 very interesting stories that I hope I will get to in the next couple of days. Here's one from McClatchy, the investigative journalist that I used to respect in Washington, D.C. A new Russian influence operation has surfaced that mirrors some of the activity of an internet firm that the FBI says was deeply involved in efforts to sway the 2016 U.S. elections, according to a cybersecurity firm. A website called USAReally.com appeared on the internet May 17, called on Americans to rally in front of the White House June 14 to celebrate Donald Trump's birthday. According to FireEye, a cybersecurity company based near Silicon Valley, USAReally is a Russian-operated website that carries content designed to foment racial division, harden feelings over immigration, gun control, and police brutality, and undermine social cohesion. If that's the case, why aren't they working on, say, the national anthem imbroglio? Or other disputes that are American-based and fought out here? I mean, this is just silly. And if you listen to the questions raised by Jack Matlack, well, this article is a headline with very little behind it. Now, a spokesman for the cybersecurity firm said the site has over 100 articles. They're posting an average of 9 a day. And they claim that while they can't prove that it came from the Internet Research Agency or the building that it used to be in St. Petersburg, they believe so. Now, this is the kind of yellow journalism that has developed since the Russiagate narrative surfaced. People are so highly suggestible, they already know that Putin personally directed the meddling in the 2016 election. And so whatever follows on that and quotes the intelligence reports, well, I believe the bullshit before. I guess I better believe this bullshit too. It's so frustrating. Over the weekend, Giuliani was at it again. Rudy 9/11 Giuliani goes on the TV shows trying to defend Trump. And this weekend, it was focused on a memo from lawyers that was written in January and only recently surfaced, in which they argued that Trump can't possibly obstruct justice because he runs all of the agencies beneath him. And that Giuliani was asked on Sunday morning shows more than once, will Trump pardon himself? And of course, that is a bit of a trick question. Because in order to issue a pardon, somebody has to be convicted of a crime. Now, Richard Nixon is a bit of exception to the argument I just said, because he had not been convicted, but Gerald Ford did pardon him of any crimes that he might be accused of. And I suppose Trump could try to pull the same number. But I think that it's almost politically impossible while he is a sitting president. And we're told that Bob Mueller is not going to try to indict a sitting president. So I don't know how the hell Trump would issue a pardon when he hasn't been indicted. It really doesn't make sense, and the pardon power does not apply to the prospect of impeachment. So this is now floated out there, and it leaves Trump exposed as a guy with dictatorial leanings. His tweet today, as has been stated by numerous legal scholars, I have the absolute right to pardon myself, but why would I do that when I have done nothing wrong? Well, why would you assert the power when you've done nothing wrong? And you would have no reason to even consider the question. So, this is a move that doesn't help Trump, it doesn't help Giuliani, and it once again leaves the perception that Trump is not only a demagogue, but a would-be dictator. And that is buttressed by another memo that was released, a 22-page legal opinion that was released late on Thursday. The Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department said that Trump could lawfully and unilaterally direct airstrikes targeting Syria, which he has done twice, and that it doesn't require any congressional notification or approval because it would be in the national interest and because the attack would carry little risk of escalation. Now, that last part, how can you say with any certainty that an attack on Syria with Russian aircraft on the ground and in the sky on a regular basis, that there might not be any escalation? Now, there hasn't been in these two incidents where Trump launched missiles at Syria. But that does not predict anything for the future. And Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, a Democrat, said, is there any doubt that America would view a foreign nation firing missiles at targets on American soil an act of war? The ludicrous claim that this president can magically assert national interest and redefine war to exclude missile attacks and thereby bypass Congress should alarm us all. This is further proof that Congress must finally take back its authority when it comes to war. Well, I agree with that. And there's an interesting disclosure that in the National Defense Authorization Act, the Pentagon budget bill that was passed by the House in February and that gives $70 billion to the Pentagon that Trump didn't even ask for, it includes a clause, quote, "It is the sense of Congress that the use of the armed forces against Iran is not authorized by this act or any other act." It was Keith Ellison, the Democrat from Minnesota, the only Muslim that I know of serving in Congress, who wrote that into the bill, and it was passed by a fat majority in the House. Now, I don't believe the Senate has yet taken this up, and Marjorie Cohn wrote about this at truthout.org. I think it's a very interesting angle, but I don't think that it is airtight. Meanwhile, protests continue over the killing of a woman in Gaza. 21-year-old Razan Najjar was a volunteer paramedic who had helped evacuate and treat wounded during the 10 weeks of protests that continue there, and she was shot by an Israeli sniper. I've seen video that indicated that she was clearly unarmed and appeared to have her hands up at the time she was killed by an Israeli bullet. I saw a headline in the New York Times saying that she had lost her life, but my local paper, the San Francisco Chronicle, properly wrote as the headline, "Protests erupt over killing of Palestinian paramedic." On Friday at the United Nations, the United States took a vote that shows just how isolated we are in our outsized and unquestioning support for Israel. Nikki Haley, the American ambassador, vetoed a measure backed by Arab countries to protect Palestinians and condemn Israel. She accused the measure's authors of absolving Hamas, the militant group that controls Gaza, and organized the protests. This isolated the United States, which was the sole no vote on the measure. 10 members of the Security Council voted in favor, and 4 abstained. And this is an indication of just what a rogue nation looks like. We are that rogue nation. And Trump is giving consideration to a move that would strengthen the power of David Friedman. Friedman is the U.S. ambassador to Israel. He is now in the embassy in Jerusalem. He, of course, was Trump's bankruptcy attorney who has been a steadfast supporter of the illegal Israeli settlements. So now Friedman may be given more authority over Palestinian affairs by being put in charge of the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, which has traditionally been the place where Palestinians made contact with the U.S. State Department. This is a dangerous move. We have another rogue ambassador, this one in Germany, an appointee of Trump, Richard Grenell, has given advice in a Breitbart interview, quote, "I absolutely want to empower other conservatives throughout Europe. I think there is a groundswell of conservative policies that are taking hold because of the failed policies of the left." Now, this is an implicit criticism of nations, including Germany, that the U.S. considers allies. And for Grenell to make this statement is a gross violation of protocol. I hope they will bounce him and send him home. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Patrick Garay, Andrew Harnack, Susan Lundgren, and Virginia Suters Mason just renewed her annual subscription. Ginger is also a great volunteer producer who supports my video shows here on the local cable system. And I'd like you to join in and become a subscriber, too. All you have to do is go to peterbcollins.com, find the menu tab, pull it down, click on Become a Subscriber. You land on the sign-up page, and I've got a new bonus gift on the way that I'll be announcing shortly for people who take out a new annual subscription. Two people I respect, retired Army Colonel Ann Wright and Medea Benjamin of Code Pink for Peace. They have penned an op-ed in today's Guardian that's worth reading. They offer 3 pieces of advice for the Trump negotiators after a recent trip to South Korea. They are arguing that North Korea has made concessions in advance of the June 12th Singapore summit. And they argue that the U.S. should open an interest section in Pyongyang and allow a North Korean interest section in Washington. They should lift the travel ban, and they should provide humanitarian support to the starving population in North Korea. I think it's good advice. I am linking to this commentary for your perusal. But leave it to Democrats in the United States Senate to demand terms of the summit that are almost unachievable. In a letter to Trump today, they said that any deal with North Korea must completely dismantle Pyongyang's nuclear and ballistic missile programs permanently, and that the White House must loop Congress in on its plans before negotiations begin. The senators wrote, any deal that explicitly or implicitly gives North Korea sanctions relief for anything other than the verifiable performance of its obligations to dismantle its nuclear and missile arsenal is a bad deal. Now, this is really stupid, because it appears to me that the June 12th summit could be a success if only they declare an end to the 1950s Korean War and move toward a treaty to that effect. But to try to load up demands in advance of this meeting, given what a bad negotiator Trump actually is and how unskilled he is in international affairs, nuclear issues, military issues, if they express no confidence in him as a negotiator, I'd be right with them. But to try to undermine these negotiations, I think, is really dangerous and reckless. And Bob Menendez, the senator from New Jersey, is one of the loudest, most hawkish voices who signed on to that letter. And in a great piece of The Intercept today, Glenn Greenwald exposes how the Democrats in New Jersey and in Washington have closed ranks to put this corrupt guy into another term in the U.S. Senate. They have essentially choked off any funding for potential challengers in the Democratic primary, and he is going to win easily the nomination and probably coast to victory in November. But this is the guy who was just censured by the Senate Ethics Committee. Over a six-year period, Menendez knowingly and repeatedly accepted gifts of significant value from his buddy Dr. Melgen without obtaining required committee approval and failed to publicly disclose certain gifts as required. But the Democrats, who are so up in arms about all the corruption on the Trump side, fail to see it on their own side. And when you consider how they forced out Al Franken for some unwanted groping and kissing that didn't particularly violate a law and didn't show at least any financial ethics weakness on the part of Senator Franken, well, the double standard is extremely clear. Today marks 5 years since Ed Snowden revealed some of those NSA documents that he pirated. We've never seen all of them, never will. And Ed Snowden gave an interview to The Guardian, which had been instrumental in the initial reports on the secret stuff that he revealed. And he told them the people are still powerless, but now they are aware. He is satisfied with the way his revelations of mass surveillance have rocked governments, intelligence agencies, and major internet companies. He knew at the moment 5 years ago that his old life was over. It was scary, but it was liberating. There was a sense of finality. There was no going back. And I do applaud Ed Snowden. I consider him a hero, not a traitor. But I do quibble with giving him credit, because what he did was provide documents that confirmed what the most courageous whistleblowers like Bill Binney and Kirk Wiebe and Russ Tice and others had revealed before that. Over the weekend, there was an online vigil in support of Julian Assange, who is in a very difficult place at the Embassy of Ecuador in London. They have cut off his communications. He has not been able to see a doctor, and he is reported to be ill. And so Professor Mark Crispin Miller of NYU spent an hour with Elizabeth Voss, the editor-in-chief of Disobedient Media. The vigil also included Lee Camp, Caitlin Johnstone, John Kiriakou, and others. And this is the first of a weekly series. A minute or two ago, I was praising The Intercept's lead reporter, Glenn Greenwald, for his piece about Bob Menendez. But I am scratching my head at not just one, but two lengthy articles at The Intercept today, which refer to and update the case of Reality Winner. Now, I have great empathy for Reality Winner. I support her as a defendant in a badly brought espionage case. I don't quite understand what motivated her to release a document that didn't have a lot of impact. But most notably, these two articles, one by Trevor Tim and the other by Peter Moss, describe the way that Reality Winner's leak led to her investigation and prosecution. But they leave out the critical role of The Intercept's Matthew Cole, who had previously burned John Kiriakou, Joe Hickman, and perhaps others. And they talk about how The Intercept is giving money to the defense fund for Reality Winner. But they always sidestep the issues of the sequence of events where Matthew Cole went to a contact asking them to verify the accuracy of the document that Reality Winner had leaked. And that's what led the FBI to go pick her up. And this refusal to acknowledge their role is really frustrating, and it undermines the good journalism that also appears on The Intercept pages. Well, Facebook is backpedaling now, and it appears that Mark Zuckerberg was not completely honest in his testimony before Congress, particularly related to the deals that allowed data sharing of Facebook users with certain app developers, and now we know that at least 60 device makers, these are people like Apple, Amazon, BlackBerry, Microsoft, and Samsung, who make the vast majority of the smartphones. And originally, they didn't have apps for Facebook, and so as kind of a double back-scratching move, Facebook enabled them to offer customers popular features of the social network and allowed the companies to access the data of users and, most importantly, their friends without explicit consent. And most of these partnerships remain in effect, even though Facebook has told us that they changed the rules way back in 2014 and cut off these people like Cambridge Analytica from accessing and exploiting user data. Well, on Capitol Hill, Zuckerberg admitted that the BlackBerry people had that special access, but he forgot about the 59 other companies that also had that kind of access to our data. Here's another spin job for you. Bill Clinton went on the Today Show to talk about a new novel that he has co-written, and he was asked if he had apologized to Monica Lewinsky for the sexual affair that led to his impeachment but not his removal from office. And he said, well, I've never talked to her, but I did say publicly on more than one occasion that I was sorry. That's very different. The apology was public. And back in 1998, he did say, it is important for me that everyone who's been hurt know that the sorrow I feel is genuine, first and most important, my family and Monica Lewinsky. That appears to be the last time he ever mentioned her by name. And he tries to spin this up and rationalize it, saying, oh, it was 20 years ago. He talks about all the women he appointed to top positions, both as governor of Arkansas and president of the United States. And he says that the Me Too movement is a good thing, but golly, you know, this is the interest in him is mostly driven by the issues related to Trump. And then he tried this. Well, I think this thing, it's 20 years ago. Come on, let's talk about JFK. Let's talk about, you know, LBJ. Stop already. And finally today, Joy Reid has issued a fresh apology. And I'm not willing to accept it, because she is saying that her old blog had some items that she's embarrassed by. At least this time, she didn't blame murky, unidentified hackers for going in and changing her blog 10 or 15 years after she wrote a post. But what offends me is that she is apologizing because on a blog post, she suggested that readers watch the documentary Loose Change, which exposes the lies that we were told about 9/11 in the official account from the 9/11 Commission. Now, the New York Times goes a little further and says that the film posits that the attack was planned by the United States government. I watched Loose Change several times, and I don't believe they made that claim. They simply raised questions about the official narrative and offered documentation or hypotheticals about why the story that we've been told could not be true. And I wish that Joy Reid had the cojones to say, yeah, I made that post, and even if I don't agree with the conclusions or the presentation in Loose Change, I was recommending that people watch it, and it's my First Amendment right to do so. No, Joy Reid doesn't have that kind of a moral core or intellectual integrity. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You'll find it on YouTube. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.